content marketing is a good long-term strategy. Well, what I've done previously is I've used a lot of JV relationships and used affiliates, an affiliate network to help send traffic, you know, to those products. And once you sort of build up a momentum, then your brand starts to get known and you start to pick up a lot more traffic naturally.
This is Super Fast Business with James Schramko. James Schramko. Helping you build your business super fast.
James Schramko here. Thank you for listening to superfastbusiness.com. And I've got another interview really out and about finding people, digging up the talent on all sorts of different topics. And today's guest is someone who I was hanging out with at a recent conference in San Diego. I was sitting in the back of the room discussing this enamoring topic of software and how you set up software development. It's a fascinating topic. So I've brought on to the show an expert in this subject, Paul Clifford. Welcome.
Hey, James. Thanks for inviting me on the show. Would appreciate it.
Now, you are doing something fairly disruptive out in the marketplace. I think you've even called your website Disruptware or something around that. Is that right? Disruptware.com?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, essentially, like, my background's always been in software, and especially in the SaaS market. And SaaS stands for software as a service. So essentially, it's software delivered on the web. And what happened, you know, my last SaaS business where I was actually an employee, we sold that company for like $38 million. And since then, I moved and started up on my own and started learning online marketing and how to sell online and everything like that. And I started building some apps, some content marketing apps. I've got a keyword tool, there's some security software, and I've got another SaaS app in progress. But, you know, what I really found is that in the marketing world, you know, a lot of people are coming to me asking, how do I do this? How do I do that? You know, then there's lots of people launching, you know, little apps, which really they're built on sand, you know, they fall over after a little while. And my approach really is to, you know, build a software business. You've got this opportunity now where, you know, you can really create software much faster, easier, and cheaper than ever before, which means it's also easy to go wrong, right? But using like my expertise and my experience in this world and combining that with the marketing knowledge, you know, I decided to sort of put together a forum-based community, you know, and a mastermind where, you know, I'll be there, you know, every day helping other software entrepreneurs who either want to start up and get into software or they've already got something and they want to scale. And I put all that together and we've called that Disruptware.
Nice. Well, you know, I've seen some good examples. One of my regular guests on this show is Clay Collins, and he built Lead Pages, and that is probably one of the greatest success stories. I know it's in the top 1,000 websites in the world now as an app. It's a software as a service. It's so sensible. And he really jumped from this marketing crowd where there was a lot of WordPress plugins into the online app space. And he went up a category, and something struck my mind when we were sitting in the conference there with about 2,500 attendees. You said to me, well, this is a very small market for you. Who do you think we're really talking to here?
In terms of Disruptware?
Yeah, who should be building software businesses and paying attention to the stuff that you're talking about? Who's your target audience?
Right. So, you know, there's two kind of levels. You know, there's everyone who wants to get into software. So, and, you know, my network, again, has two strings to it. You know, I've got the marketing world, which I've sort of grown up with over the last few years. And those are all the people who really just want to get into it. They've started creating desktop apps or plugins and things like that, and really want to know, like, how do they scale that? How do they take that to the next level? And how do they get into SaaS? And then there's more the other side, which is, you know, any entrepreneur or info marketer or anything like that wants to, you know, create a real business that isn't something that's just going to fall over next year and something that they've got to keep working at. The great thing about creating a software business is there's so many ways you can exit from it, or not at all if you don't want to. You know, you can create a lifestyle business or you can create something to sell. But either way, it's like a real business. Okay. You know, and all you got to know really is it going to work? Is your idea going to work? And, you know, and how can you build it?
Well, that sounds very simple there. And I think we should dig into that. So yeah, You've got to know. And I know there's whole courses on this. I've had guests before from the foundation, and that was a pretty popular course in certainly in the marketing space. And I think the appeal was that you didn't have to have an idea. You didn't have to have money. You just had to follow the course. Can it be that simple?
To a certain extent, you know, I think what we have to remember is that the whole world of software has changed, you know, radically, especially over literally the last sort of 3 or 4 years. And a lot of this has come from a movement called the Lean Startup by a chap called Eric Ries. And, you know, what was happening basically is, you know, all these startups in the old days, that they required huge development teams, huge money, and you never really knew whether it was going to work. When I was in my corporate days, I had a development team of 40 people. You know, it took an age to get stuff done. And what the lean sort of startup movement is about is getting the minimum possible product, even on paper, even a PowerPoint to a certain extent, you know, getting your idea into something that you can test, you know, with a customer or with a prospect. And the sooner that you can, you know, create something that you can communicate your idea to a customer and work out whether it's really going to solve a problem, yeah, then the more your whole business model becomes validated.
Minimum viable product.
Exactly. The minimum viable product, or MVP, as it's called. You know, because what you've got to remember is that, you know, 75% of startups fail. Okay, so, you know, it sounds like a huge number. And the key thing to understand is the people who actually succeed, you know, so in that remaining 25%, their plan A, you know, so their original idea isn't actually their success. Okay, so the idea is that you create your plan A or whatever your initial thinking is, and that will evolve. It's going to evolve into, you know, your plan B or your plan C. Okay, and it's whatever that is going to be the business that you're going to end up with. You know, for example, if you look at some of the big successes, they never started out like that. Like Hotmail, you know, everyone knows Hotmail, but it never started as a mailing app. You know, they started that. It was called JavaSoft. It was, and what they wanted to do is create a database that could be accessed through the web. But, you know, their challenge was actually connecting to their email accounts. And, you know, after they went, you know, live with JavaSoft, they realized, well, hang on, no, email is a more of a pressing issue. Let's do that instead. Okay. And that's how Hotmail came about. You know, even PayPal never started, you know, as, you know, an online sort of money transfer system. You know, it was actually meant to be, it's actually started off some cryptography software, you know, for Palm Pilot, so they could actually like beam software to each other. And, you know, they dumped that idea and then, you know, took it to the web. And of course it exploded. So, you know, the point is that the people who have the great success, you know, they don't have the great success from day one. You know, they start off with their plan A, and the trick is to understand, you know, when to switch to your plan B or when to switch to your plan C. You know, so it's like it's always evolving. And in the lean startup world, he calls this pivoting or pivot. So, you know, the key thing is really to build something as quickly as you possibly can and as cheaply as you possibly can. And nowadays it's much easier to do that than it's ever been before because of, you know, the global economy and outsourcing, and we've got these great freelancer sites, or you can partner up with someone techie. You know, you can get something done really, really quickly out of your own pocket and start testing that on your potential customers and validate whether it's something that's going to solve their problem. Does that make sense, right?
It does make sense. And what you're saying is that there's going to be a number of iterations from where you start. So you start with something and it's going to evolve. And I've heard the term build, measure, learn loop.
Yeah.
So you build something, you measure the results, you learn the outcomes, and then you can make decisions from that. And I guess to some extent, that's pretty much how I've run my business from a strategic point of view. So I build out services, I put out information products, I measure all the stats and the downloads, I see what people want to buy, and then I make decisions based on that. And it's exactly the same for software. But let's just zoom in a little bit. It sounds easy. You've got all this global outsourcing talent. You've got software designers who can design stuff. You don't have to bring too much to the party because your customer's going to validate your ideas. What would be the sequence of events that someone would start from if they have a blank whiteboard in front of them? What are the steps?
Right. For the people who've got no idea what they want to do, let's cover that one off for a second. You know, I see two fundamental approaches you can take. The first one is you can, in what I call, invent a better wheel. Okay, so you can take something that's, you know, that's already working, so that's already selling, so some other competitor, and, you know, by knowing that it's already working and it's successful, you know there's a market there and an appetite for it. And then all you have to do then is really analyze how you can make that better, all right? How you can make it quicker, how you can make it easier to use, or perhaps, you know, how you can take that to a different market, you know, and niche down, you know, go really, really small, you know, into a specific market which you have knowledge in, okay? Because I think there's a lot of people who want to be entrepreneurs who might be in that, you know, corporate world at their desk job and thinking, you know, I just don't have that great idea, okay? And, you know, when you really get your head around it and understand that it's very rare to get that great idea, okay? I mean, Google wasn't the first to search, right? You know, they weren't the first, but they took something that was already there from Yahoo and just made it much, much better. Even, you know, I mean, look at Apple and the iPod, okay? There were MP3 players around before the iPod came into being. Yeah, I mean, you know. So
talking about that today with a friend of mine, and I realized that half the people listening to my show won't even know what a Walkman was. Yeah. It's kind of embarrassing.
Oh, I remember those, yeah. And then the Walkman, then the Discman. So I guess, so that's one way you can look at it, okay? So to invent a better wheel. The other thing, which is a little bit more unique, and that is if you do want to do something or you recognize that there might be a gap in the market, then you need to really find that pain, you know, within your prospects. And, you know, to do that, and I suggest you only do that if you know your market, you know the industry you're in, because, you know, then you've got a good understanding. And, you know, what you need to do is ask these prospects, you know, and question whether the pain really exists, and not only whether the pain exists, whether it's monetizable. Okay. So in other words, you know, you need to ask them how they're doing this thing now, you know, how much is it costing them? What's the labor cost in reality? And it's when you start asking those kind of questions, and don't ask for the solutions. Okay. You don't want solutions. You just want to understand their problems. Then, you know, once you identify that and you understand that it's a real monetizable problem, then you can start looking at a solution for it. Okay. You know, because I mean, if you start asking them for solutions, people will say the wrong thing and it'll throw you off track. You know, I think Henry Ford was famous for saying that his customers don't know what they want, because when he went out and asked people what they want, they said faster horses.
Bit of conjecture over if that's a true quote or not, but I totally get the point of it. That, and Steve Jobs was of a similar ilk. He would not really worry too much about what people wanted, because, you know, I think he was insistent on not allowing people to have a stylus, and he just wanted one button on the iPhone. He could see forward, but I guess it's kind of hard. He wasn't really big on market research in terms of bringing in groups to tell him all about, you know, what they wanted either. How did he innovate and get ideas?
But they were they were very, very clever people, right? You know, so, and, you know, when you think a bit broader, you know, around that, you know, people like you and I, how can we actually go? I'm not saying you're not a genius, but, you know, how can we go to our market?
That, as a matter of fact, that obviously we're implying that none of our listeners are, and probably some are, but yeah. just on that, actually, one of the interesting facts about Henry Ford that I didn't realize until I watched a very long documentary about him was that he built this huge factory that could build 1,000 cars a day, and then he hated it. He felt sick about what he'd built in hindsight. So he actually did make that mistake you're talking about earlier of putting in too much effort and building something too big until he discovered that it wasn't actually what he wanted in the end.
Right, right. That's interesting. That's interesting. So I guess, you know, the covering off the idea part, you know, so once you have that, the critical thing then is really to turn that idea, get it out of your head, you know, into something on paper or on screen, you know, onto your computer. So you can actually start, you know, evolving that into something workable. And, you know, in the business, we call that a wireframe. Okay, so you start designing a wireframe. I use a tool called Balsamic or My Balsamic, and it's a really fast way to mock up screens. And what's really good about that is it validates, you know, how this thing's going to work to yourself, you know, even before it goes to any developer or whatever. You know, when you start drawing this thing, you'll start to realize whether, you know, this screen should have this or this button or whatever. And the whole thing will start to come alive as you design it on screen. And with Balsamic, what you can do is you can link screens together behind certain buttons. So let's say you put a button on the screen like OK, then you can link that to another wireframe. So, you know, after a little while, you end up, you know, with some like a clickable wireframe that and you start almost to see your app come alive. So, you know, once you have that and something clickable that starts to make sense, not only to you, but also that's something you can actually take to your prospects. Okay. So you can actually take that to your market and it's clickable and it really helps then, you know, communicate again your product, you know, to your potential customers and work out whether it's what they want, whether it's going to solve the problem, and more importantly, you know, whether they're going to pay money for it.
Very cool. So you can start showing people your concept before you have to pay someone to build it all.
Exactly. Exactly.
I remember James Dyson talking about this, had him come along to my Fastweb Formula event and share his million-dollar software secrets. And he had also mentioned that you can build out stuff on Keynote or PowerPoint to show people a mock-up of what every screen would look like as well. But the linked button sounds fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are loads and loads of tools. I mean, there's a whole industry around wireframing. I just like Balsamic because it's very easy to use. It's very quick to build screens. I did it like a demo walkthrough on my site. And so it's something that anyone can pick up and run with. So I guess, you know, the next step then is, you know, with, you know, how you get this thing built. So let's assume you've gone through this process now. So you've got like a clickable wireframe. What you need to think about is, are there any sort of complex processes behind certain buttons? Okay. And anything that you think is particularly complex, then you're worth writing down, you know, just bullet points. And again, you can do this within the tool as well. But it's important to have, you know, your complete vision of what your version one or your MVP is going to look like, all sketched out. Because the rule of thumb is that the more time you spend in this process, you know, getting your design as right as you think you can, then the less money you'll spend in the development process.
Sounds like building a house.
Right.
If you design it properly and they can build it first time, then you don't have to rework stuff when you realize the door can't open or that something's too short or you've got the wrong material.
Exactly, exactly. And the cost of all development comes at the back end. You know, it comes with the bugs and the reworking code and, you know, and all that sort of stuff. So the more you can get that thinking done at the front end, then it's going to save you a fortune down the line. So I guess, you know, now you've got that, then you got to get this built, right? And generally there's like two approaches. You can either partner with someone, okay? So let's say you've got someone really, you know, good technical guy, and, you know, of course, doing that, then you don't necessarily have to put your hand in your pocket and pay out cash straight away. Of course, there's disadvantages with partnering, and that is that, you know, what happens if they aren't technically as good as what you thought they were? Secondly, you're giving away a lot of equity.
That's the biggest problem.
Straight away.
That's the biggest hidden problem I've found with partnerships. Mm. It's not if they don't go well, because there's, you know, you lose a bit of energy or time, but it's if they're wildly successful. The partnership can be terrible. I look at things like Facebook. It caused a bit of conflict there when people want to take ownership and bump other people off the boat and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you want to do the partnership approach, you really got to write down, even if it's just in an email, but at least write down, you know, what happens if it's successful? What happens if it fails? What's our end goal? You know, are we going to sell it? Are we going to just live off the profit? What happens if I lose interest or you lose interest, which does happen a lot, right?
Yes.
You know, can you buy each other out?
And that's where you have to have a strong strategy. Okay, so if you don't have the capital, you could give a share to a developer. That's sort of what you're saying here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And the other way to do it, of course, is, you know, to outsource or to hire a developer. And, you know, you can do that through, obviously, recommendation, or you can do that through, you know, one of the services online. There's a whole load of them now. The one I particularly like is freelancer.com, only because that particular service is like evolved from years ago, and it used to be called Rentacoder. So the marketplace on freelancer.com is, you know, very strong in developers, you know, unlike Odesk and some of the others. And, you know, with that sort of pedigree, you tend to get much better applications coming through for your project. So let me just step you through that then. So if you, so you've got your wireframe, okay, so you've got your design sort of pretty much ready, and what you want to do now is get some bids on that. So the first rule of thumb is always look for, or basically you want to bid on a fixed price basis, okay? So you never want to pay a freelancer by the hour. It's always on a fixed price. And what you do is you sort of put your project on Freelancer and you start getting people applying with prices and bidding for your project. And, you know, the key things, you know, to know, because obviously it's a big topic, but the key things to know is make your shortlist based on their feedback, okay? So their ratings, because it's a marketplace with reviews and things like that. So, you know, look through what they've done before, and in your description of your project, specifically ask them for examples of similar work. Okay, so you want essentially to have people bidding on that who've done very much the similar sort of thing before using similar sort of technologies. Okay, never go for the highest price, but equally never go for the lowest price. You'll start to see what feels right. It's going to be somewhere in the middle, and you'll start to get more bids in the middle. And the next thing to do is really get them chatting. You know, you need to have some sort of chat with them, with the individual, and start asking them for examples of their work, talking through that, what problems have they faced before, and start building a rapport. And, you know, it's, you'll find once you've done two or three of these, you'll start to really understand whether the guy knows what he's talking about, but also, you know, whether you can communicate with this developer on a daily, weekly, whatever basis. The other little tip is, if you can, is get them on Skype. All right. So then, you know, you're talking to them, you know, directly, and you'd be able to, you know, when they're online. You want to basically make sure that once this project started, that they don't disappear off and everything. And the only reason that some people disappear on these sites is because often they're embarrassed to admit that they've hit an issue. So, you know, especially in some countries, their culture is such that they would rather just stay quiet than come to you with a problem. And what you want really is you want to know about the problem as soon as possible, because you know that you can work around anything. Right? You can find a solution between the two of you. And so it's really important to get that communication going. Is that making sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So just a quick recap here.
Yeah.
We have got our idea. We're either making a better wheel or addressing a pain point. We've documented it. We've put it up on a wireframe. We've got someone to say, yeah, this is valuable. I'll pay you for this. You have spec'd out the software brief, either getting a partner or put it up for bid on Freelancer, and you want a fixed price. And you've done a bit of an interview process of the shortlisted people, not the highest or the lowest bidder, but someone with a good rating. And you've got a good enough working rapport that you feel you can slice through any objections.
Exactly. You know, basically what you do is you agree the time frames, you know, when you want this delivered. If it's quite a large project, then it's good to break it into milestones. Yeah. So, you know, you have like a version 0.1 or whatever, and this is what should be in this version.
And is that how you pay as well?
Exactly. Exactly. So you can pay on milestones as well. So then it's kind of a win-win. They know that they're not committing to months of work or weeks of work with nothing. And then, you know, you're also seeing results, you know, throughout the process. Okay.
Very good. So it's everyone's moving forward at the same pace. I must admit, I think I made one of these mistakes, and I kind of went to a projected amount for a software but ended up paying sort of hourly rates, and it cost me a lot more than I expected. And I got past that point where I was so far into it, I had to just keep going to get any kind of return, and it was unappealing.
Yeah, I know.
I'm sure you've been there, and other people have too, but we're going to save a whole lot of mistakes by going through this in detail.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, you know, the great thing is that when you do find someone really good, then you can build a much more long-term relationship with them anyway. And, you know, and then if necessary, you can move to hourly, you know, further down the line, because you've got to trust, you know, and you know how fast they work and everything else. And working on hourly basis is a little bit easier, because you don't have to define everything up front. But, you know, for the first project, for the initial thing, do everything as fixed price and get it milestoned and work out your timeline. Now, obviously, to you personally, you don't communicate this, but you need to like possibly double or triple whatever their estimate is, okay? Because, you know, that they're going to go in very enthusiastically into something and it's going to be more complicated than they first thought. Things will drag on.
It always seems to cost twice as much and take twice as long. Always.
Exactly. But if you fix price it, right, so you're protected from the financial perspective, but all you've got to do is just tell yourself, okay, it's going to take at least two or three times as long as what they're telling me.
That's, okay. That is very funny that it's it seems a phenomenon. It's like weather forecasts or cooking recipe oven times. They never seem accurate.
Yeah, exactly. So once you've awarded the freelancer the job, then off they go and they start building, you know, your software. A couple of key points. First of all, make sure you're speaking to them, you know, at least every week, if not every other day. Just check in. Okay. You just want to check in, like, how's everything going? Any problems? You know, and get some feedback. Okay. It's critical that you do that. Don't leave it for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and then check in with the guy. Okay. That's when where most of the disasters happen. All right. You need to be on their case like every few days. And then the second thing is you want to build. So you want a delivery of whatever it is they're building as soon as possible, whether it's complete or not. And, you know, I suggest weekly. So every week you need them to deliver you the code, even though there might be like one feature in it, but you want that delivered to you every week as the project moves on. You know, and there's two reasons for that. One is because, you know, first of all, you've got the code on your side. So if anything does go wrong, then you can find someone else to take over. The second thing is you can start testing as soon as possible. And the sooner you start testing it, the sooner you log bugs. And what you should be doing is ensuring that they're fixing bugs during the project, not at the end.
Right. Does it tend to blow out the time to complete, especially when you keep trying to add features, when you find something like, oh, we should have done this differently. The feature creep, I suppose they call it.
Yeah. I'll come to that in a second. But on the bug side, you'll find that it doesn't really, okay? Because remember, they're kind of under pressure in a way to commit. You know, they committed to a time frame.
Yep.
Yeah. And all you're doing is logging bugs, okay? And when they estimated that time frame, they would have estimated in the bug fixing anyway. The difference is that you're getting them to fix the bugs during the project rather than leaving everything to the end. And the reason for that is that when you leave everything to the end, you end up with a completely unknown timescale, right? So, you know, if you've got like 100 or so bugs, you don't know how long they're going to take to fix.
You want it to happen in like one of the phases rather than on after completion.
Exactly. But if you're fixing 20 bugs a week, yeah, then at the end of it, you probably only have 20 bugs left.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fact of life, no matter what. And then in terms of the other point you made, which is about scope creep or feature creep, this is where you need to be strong on yourself, you know, and this is where you really need to, because you're going to have tons of ideas, you know, and you're going to think, oh, why don't we do that? That'd be really cool, you know, and that's really where you've got to kind of put those things aside, maybe put them in your, whatever you're using to, you know, design your project, whatever, you know, design it up, get it all ready, but don't give it to them, you know, until the end of the project. Okay. You know, store everything aside because, you know, once you get the final version, you might have changed your mind completely, but it's the worst thing. You know, once you start throwing features and they start working on a feature in the middle of a project, then all your time scales get blown out. And more importantly, they've then got a reason to come back to you with a delay.
Yeah. Cause you changed this or you changed that.
Exactly.
Okay. So let's imagine that we've been really disciplined. We've bug hunted. We've developers still on board, everything's going well, and we now have our delivered software. What do we do with that? Well, I guess we've got to sell it or go back to our customers now and market it.
Yeah, essentially. You know, so, you know, you've already got now some prospects interested because you've already started talking to them. And as soon as you have this initial build, then you can now go back to them and say, hey, you know, you said that you had this problem and you said it's a real issue. Well, you know, here's my solution that we've already talked about. And you can actually start asking them for money potentially. Some people will give, you know, a customer free access. Mm-hmm. You know, there's two schools of thought. Really what you want to do is kind of get them to pay something because, you know, as soon as they pay something, then they're emotionally committed to it, right? They will invest more in using it and raising issues to you than if you give it to them for free.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I literally just interviewed someone the other day on my blog about this, and that's exactly what he did. He wouldn't, his whole beta group, you know, he called like the grandfather club or something, or the founders club. You know, obviously he gave him a special rate, but he wouldn't give it to them for free. And the key thing is then they've bought in, you know, they're using it as part of their business. And it comes back to the whole thing about freemium software. You know, you sell so much freemium software, a lot of people just won't use it.
Yes, you know, I've seen a lot of pricing schedules, and it seems to lean, certainly when I've done testing on my membership, it seems to lean towards having a little bit of stakeholding happening with the cost up front. Even if you have less people, the people there are wanting to be there.
Right. And also, you know, don't just expect it to sell itself, you know, just on marketing. Okay. You know, you've already built a rapport with some of these people. There's no reason why you can't, you know, speak to some more, like via the phone or meet or anything like that. I think a lot of people, I mean, we talk a lot about marketing and you know, online sales and everything like that, you know, and that's obviously the big part of it. But, you know, some people get wrapped up so much in that side, they forget that, you know, often you can phone these people, you know, and show them the software yourself. And it's a lot easier to close a customer face to face, yeah, than, you know, if you're just doing everything online and building up your marketing funnels and everything else. Makes sense, right? I mean, even the biggest, some of the big software tools like Kissmetrics, you know, very, very successful SaaS app, you know, what they're really good at is as soon as you sign up for your free trial, you know, the next day your phone rings.
Wow.
You know, that they're on you straight away. Just want to check if things are all right. How can I set you up? Can I help you with this? Can I give you a quick demo through, you know, that they're on your case. Yeah. I mean, in the business, it's called inside sales, but, you know, basically they establish that touch point straight away.
Yeah, that's very good. And it's a marketing sequence. So the game is to move people from engaged user to paying engaged user. And I've just been through that with a service that I joined a week or two ago. I think it's called mention.net. And they're very ambitiously trying to move me through to pay customer. And also my eWay gateway have been sending me emails, you know, encouraging me to take up some anti-fraud software. And all they asked me to do is just reply, yes, I'm interested. And the next thing you know, the phone's ringing. So they've got this link up between segmented customers and, you know, offline call to action.
Yeah, exactly.
So a lot of this, I guess, will depend on the market you're in. Let's see. So you've given us a great sort of run through of the steps from start to finish to have a product ready. What do you think some of the biggest mistakes you've seen people making with software have been?
I think there's a classic one right at the start, okay, that you're not solving a problem.
Right.
Yeah. You're creating, you know, a product maybe out of emotion, you know. It could be, hey, someone else has got this out, I got to do one too, you know, and you create something and obviously it doesn't solve the problem at all, and it just, you know, no one buys it.
They're just releasing a complete ripoff of a product that doesn't go any further or add any extra value to solving the problem.
Right. Exactly. The other thing, when I talk to people, the other big thing that goes wrong with outsourcing is pretty much what I've covered in terms of, you know, the communication piece. You know, that's, I think people would invest a lot of time in doing their design, their wireframe, put it on a freelance site, you know, click the button, hire them, and then just expect something to end up, you know, on their plate 4 weeks later.
So they're not working it enough.
Yeah. You know, you have to kind of work the system. It just, you can't just expect to put something out there and just expect a finished result, you know, 4 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever the time frame is back.
The courses out there sort of imply that it is that easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, send off a PowerPoint deck. Next week, you'll have a number one app on Apple.
Yeah. Disaster, right?
It seems to be. That's why I'm interested in it. You know, and I do have SaaS, but I don't think I've done as well as I could have with it. And I've ended up bundling it in with my membership for my community members. But it was based around solving my own pain.
Yeah.
And, you know, goes to figure that a lot of people also have the same pain that I have, and it solves their problem too.
Scratching your own itch. basically.
Exactly. And I have enough of a community of people who are in the same sort of boat as me. So it did make sense at the time.
Yeah. I think, you know, the freelance, the outsourcing bit is a classic one that goes wrong. I think getting your idea out of your head into a wireframe and just spending a bit of time with that, you know, that's another thing. You know, I think inherently, you know, people can be lazy. I'm lazy. You know, I would much rather, you know, just phone a developer and say, hey, I've got this idea. Can you just go and build it? You know, that's what we'd want to do. And I think, you know, going through the process of designing a wireframe is like a little pain that you just have to do, because it helps you imagine it and evolve the product yourself, you know, and communicate to yourself before you put it out there. It's a really good way of, you know, aligning the idea into something that's actually workable, you know, an actual tool that's going to work. So I think that, you know, those are the two, I guess, two or three, you know, main issues. And of course, making sure that the pain, you know, that you're trying to solve is monetizable. Okay. You know, there's no good solving a problem. You know, it's like solving a problem for a lawyer is going to have a lot more value maybe than solving a problem for a school. Okay. Even though solving problem for the school would be great, you know, but in terms of monetary value and how much they're going to pay for it, that's really what you've got to really think about.
So really a lot of this, like all good marketing, should really focus on the customer. Be really clear on who your customer is, how you can reach them, what they're willing to pay for, what they already pay for is a great example. And you build up from there.
Yeah. Exactly. And you know, try, you know, once you've got this whole thing live, try not to get too emotionally involved. You know, start working on the numbers. And I know you're great at this, James. You're very metric driven. And, you know, you need to kind of define to yourself what success looks like at each step of the way. Yeah. So, you know, say, right, in 3 months, let's say, for example, you know, I want to have 50 customers. If I want 50 customers, then how many leads do I need? You know, and if I have this many leads, and how much traffic do I need, and how am I going to convert that traffic into leads? You know, start mapping everything out in a spreadsheet so that you know whether you're on track or not. Because, you know, what's happened is you've got this great app in your mind. Sorry, you're just taking delivery of this great app. You've got a great website and everything's there, you know, but how do you know you're actually moving through and heading for sales? Yeah, without a sort of a dashboard of numbers that you can actually tick off as you go through the process.
Nice. So your whole website is centered around helping people grow a business for themselves around this software development.
Right.
What's been the biggest success you've had to date with software for yourself after you left the company?
I launched a product called Kudani, which is for content marketing, and it's for bloggers, where they could actually curate content from news feeds. It has like a news feed tool within it, and it all runs from the desktop, and that was hugely successful. And, you know, I launched that last year, and, you know, that's done multiple six figures since. So, you know, that's great. I've got a lovely, you know, security software tool that sits on people's blogs and prevents them getting hacked. You know, and even though that didn't have like, or doesn't have the same sort of revenue, it's the one that everyone loves. It's got the lowest refund rate ever, and it's very, very reliable, and it does a good job.
And what's your best marketing tactic to let people know about your software?
Content marketing is a good long-term strategy. Well, what I've done previously is I've used a lot of JV relationships and used affiliates, an affiliate network to help send traffic, you know, to those products. And once you sort of build up a momentum, then your brand starts to get known and you start to pick up a lot more traffic naturally. So it's essentially, it's a two-pronged approach. You know, you use the affiliate traffic for the launch, and then the content marketing is good for, you know, the long-term stuff.
Nice. All right. Well, I really appreciate you coming on to the show and sharing these great ideas. We've gone all the way from not even having an idea to having our software produced and then marketed to. So listeners can head over to disruptware.com, find out more about Paul and the software system. And thanks so much for coming on and sharing these ideas.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate being a guest on your show, James. You know, I follow it and I love it. I love the stuff you're doing. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Discover how to build your business
super fast.
Check out superfastbusiness.com.